seen the alternative, the royal prerogative of bringing a war. And that was precisely the kind of tyranny they wanted to avoid, that one person on a whim, or for whatever. I mean, obviously, they had not, I don't think the founders ever imagined that they would have a president who would launch a war because he was dropping in the polls, or because he wanted to divert from the Epstein files, or because he didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, it is a foundational principle here that the president cannot just decide to go to war. He can do it in an emergency. And that's why the Constitution says, doesn't say that only the Congress can make war, because they allow the president in a case of an emergency, but not to declare war and keep a war going.
We have 10 seconds. President Trump now told The Atlantic magazine they want to talk, and I've agreed to talk, so I'll be talking to them. As the U.S. and Israel strikes Iran hundreds of times, and apparently the Pentagon, the president is saying this will go on for weeks.
Well, you know, I mean, we're shifting. I mean, this shows that there was no plan here. The whole reason, I mean, one of the main reasons to have this constitutional provision is so that a war can be deliberated, so you understand what a war is about. You go to the people, you go to the Congress,
deliberate,
and you decide as a nation there should be a war or there shouldn't be.
Reed Brody, war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Down by the river, where the rain runs cold, there's a frog in Portland, brave and bold. He don't carry signs, he don't throw stones, just hops on the line with a megaphone.
ACLU Oregon has been litigating and advocating to take on ICE and Border Patrol abuses and violations. Join me on Prison Pipeline, March 2nd, 6:30 p.m. to hear Sandy Chung from ACLU Oregon about how ACLU is protecting our immigrant communities and upholding all our civil liberties. That's Prison Pipeline, March 2nd, 6:30 p.m.
Ribbit, 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 let freedom sing. It's a funny old way to do your thing. With a smile and a hop, you can make your stand in a frog suit holding freedom's hand. With the chicken, the shark, and the unicorn parade, we all march proud in the Frog Brigade.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Washington State Department of Ecology, hosting a workshop about geothermal energy opportunities and risks in the Wind River Valley on March 5th at the Stevenson Community Library, or virtually. More information is available at ecy.wa.gov/geothermal.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, after the U.S. bombs Iran, Portlanders protest and against the strikes.
Oregon lawmakers consider a bill to reverse campaign finance laws before they take effect.
And Washington State invests in wildfire prevention.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 2nd, 2026. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Dave Johnson. The U.S. and Israel bombed Iran on Saturday, killing Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Portlanders reacted in protest, and Oregon Democratic representatives voiced their opposition. Protesters with the group Portland for Palestine rallied Sunday, holding signs reading, "Stop the War on Iran Now." Demonstrators expressed worry about the U.S. starting another conflict similar to the Iraq War. Later in the day, hundreds of Iranian Americans rallied at Pioneer Courthouse Square to celebrate the strikes. The group, Iranian Americans of Portland, has gathered regularly to ask for the government's help in toppling the Iranian government and Ayatollah Khamenei. Organizer Bahir Babudi told OPB, quote, "This is something we've been asking for, begging for, crying for 47 years, and finally it's done," end quote. Portland State Professor Anousheh Siddiqui told OPB, quote, "We know you're tired of the U.S. getting involved in other countries, but there is nothing like the lived experience of a people. I hope you never know the sheer desperation of a people praying to be bombed only to be free," end quote.
Oregon congressional representatives condemned the president's strikes on Iran over the weekend, which he did without congressional approval. Senator Jeff Merkley said the attack, quote, "shreds our Constitution, which assigns decisions of war to Congress," unquote. Oregon Representative Andrea Salinas said in a statement, quote, "Make no mistake, Iran's repressive regime is guilty of violence against its own citizens. They are state sponsors of terror, and they can never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. The Iranian people deserve to direct their own destiny, but these facts are not enough to justify military action," end quote. Senator Ron Wyden wrote on Twitter, quote, "Donald Trump is unilaterally dragging us into another costly and deadly war in the Middle East that the American people don't want," end quote. A Reuters poll this weekend found that only 1 in 4 Americans support the U.S. strikes on Iran. At least 555 people have been killed in Iran by U.S. and Israeli strikes so far, including 180 killed in an attack on a girls' school. And 6 American service members have also been killed.
The Oregon Legislature Joint Ways and Means is scheduled to hear a bill tomorrow that would dismantle and delay key parts of a compromise campaign finance law passed in 2024. HB 4018 was removed from the agenda for today's meeting, but will be before the committee at 3 p.m. tomorrow. The bill is a major departure from the campaign finance rules that were passed recently. Those rules were a big deal, and the first slate are scheduled to take effect next January. Oregon's elections are among the most expensive in the country, in large part because campaign contributions have been unregulated. HB 4018 is under heavy scrutiny from good governance groups like the League of Women Voters, Honest Elections, Common Cause, and Indivisible. The Campaign Legal Center says the bill would, quote, "weaken laws intended to prevent corruption and provide voters with information about whose is spending big money to influence their vote," end quote. Dan Meek from Honest Elections told KABU why the contribution limits are important and what's motivating state Democratic leaders to push the bill through.
On the limit, it's a basic tenet of democracy that the government should take action on behalf of all of the people. And if the politicians are totally dependent on a very narrow slice of the population, that is big corporations, big unions, wealthy individuals, then they are far more likely to take action for their benefit and not for the benefit of the people. That's what it's all about. It's protecting democracy from being totally dominated by big entities and the wealthy. Oregon has some of the highest contributions to candidates and the highest spending by political candidates per capita of any state. The amount spent, for example, in the last race of governor was $80 million. It basically doubles every 4 years. Oregon has seen some of the largest individual political contributions in American history. They come from Phil Knight, who contributes many millions of dollars to individual political candidates in the past few years. So it means that our government should represent everybody, and it shouldn't just represent the people who fund their campaigns. As far as disclosure requirements go, because of the Citizens United decision, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that anyone can make what are called independent expenditures for or against candidates. So we need to know where that money is coming from. Under current Oregon law, you don't know. all you know is the last person who touched the money before it went to buy an ad. And typically, who touched the money last is a nonprofit organization with a nice name, like Good Things for Oregon Corporation, you know, Good Things for Oregon Nonprofit Corporation. That's all that you see. When in fact, it could well be the fossil fuel industry, the chemical industry, the tobacco industry. It could be the state employee union, although unions tend to identify themselves in the ad because it's not a negative thing to identify yourself as a union. But if you're the tobacco company or oil company or chemical company, you don't want people to know where the money for the ad is coming from. So the ad comes from the Good Things for Oregon corporate, you know, nonprofit corporation. That's our existing law. What this law passed in 2024 and effective in 2028 says is that you have to drill down to the original sources of the funds. So the ads wouldn't say paid for by the Good Things for Oregon, nonprofit. It would have to say paid for by Dow Chemical, DuPont, American Tobacco, or whoever really paid for it, because it matters. The persuasiveness of political ads depends heavily on who's paying for it and who put the ad. If an ad comes on that says smoking is perfectly safe, and it comes from the American Medical Association, you think differently than if that ad came from the tobacco industry. So we want voters to know where the ads are coming from. It started in the House Rules Committee and had that perfunctory hearing within, less than a day after the amendment was published. And then they voted on it and, to advance it, and it was advanced to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, which is very strange because it really is not a bill that is revenue raising, which is what has to go to Ways and Means. So why did they send it to the Joint Ways and Means Committee? Well, the Joint Ways and Means Committee has the authority to send to approve the bill and send it to the floor of both houses, that is the House and the Senate, and bypass the Senate Rules Committee. And our chief champion is on the Senate Rules Committee, Senator Jeff Golden, from Ashland. So the Democrats want to bypass their own Senate Rules Committee, which has a majority of Democrats on it, because they think that there will be opposition in the Senate Rules Committee, and they're right, there will be. So they're using a parliamentary maneuver.
That was Dan Meek from Honest Elections speaking about HB 4018. That bill will be before the Oregon Joint Ways and Means Committee tomorrow, Tuesday, March 3rd at 3 p.m. Lawmakers must end their session by March 8th.
The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has for months punished local Portland protesters with tear gas and other crowd control munitions at the South Waterfront ICE facility. The legal battle over the use of tear gas continued today. U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simon held an evidentiary hearing. Lawyers with the ACLU of Oregon argue that federal officers violated their own policies by battering nonviolent protesters with tear gas, with pepper balls, and with flashbang grenades, literally hundreds of times since June of 2025. These attacks were perpetrated outside Portland's ICE building. Judge Simon was asked to extend the injunction, which bars excessive, indiscriminate, and unnecessary federal force. Jack Dickinson, also known as the Portland Chicken, is the lead plaintiff for the lawsuit. The case includes other protesters who say they were engaged in nonviolent protest protected by the Constitution. Ashley Albies, an ACLU of Oregon attorney, said, quote, "You can't use force on people who have not done anything to justify that use of force. If there are one or two people in a crowd who are engaging in conduct that is unlawful, the appropriate response is to arrest those people. It is not to tear gas thousands of people. That's not the appropriate response. That's not the legal response." End quote. Attorneys at the U.S. Department of Justice argue that when federal law enforcement officers are forced to respond to a crowd containing a violent subset of protesters who disrupt civic order, they may enforce dispersal orders against everyone in the vicinity. Arrest numbers connected to crimes outside the Portland ICE building are small compared to the thousands of people who have turned out to protest without being arrested or charged.
The proposed budgets from both House and Senate in Washington State both include full funding for wildfire resilience. Supporters say with Western Washington's challenging climate, including on the Makah Reservation on the Olympic Peninsula, fires are becoming more common, and investing in prevention now will save the state money in the future. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Western Washington communities are applauding the state, House, and Senate for including full wildfire prevention funding in their proposed budgets. The decisions honor a previous legislative commitment. Glenn Ellis Jr. is a board member of the Nature Conservancy and a member of the Makah Tribe. The Makah Reservation sits on the north end of the Olympic Peninsula, one of the rainiest places in the country. Ellis notes that while people rarely associate the peninsula with fire, recent years have proven otherwise.
3 years ago, we had two fires sprout up during November. It's just crazy to think that fire could spread in a place like this during that time. We get 119 inches of rain a year. We're a temperate rainforest.
The human-caused Bear Gulch fire burned more than 20,000 acres last July and was the largest wildfire on the Olympic Peninsula since 1951. Funds from what was known as House Bill 1168 that passed 5 years ago have helped 175 small forest landowners in three counties reduce wildfire risk through thinning and prescribed burns. Ellis adds research shows every dollar spent on thinning or controlled burns saves $8 in firefighting costs. Ellis says smoke from across the state also affects the reservation, worsening asthma risks and even closing schools due to poor air quality. The Makah Tribe is building a new school and must now install more expensive, high-quality air systems due to the heightened fire threat. He says these added costs are factored into funding requests and tribal budgets to future-proof such projects.
We have to now expend money to make sure that the air quality is at a level that kids can go to school during these smoky events. And the same thing with our clinic, the same thing with our gymnasium.
Ellis explains some of the funding for these projects comes from the state's Climate Commitment Act. He praises state lawmakers, at least for now, for continuing to use the funding for its intended purpose in their latest budgets. Governor Bob Ferguson's December budget proposed redirecting nearly $570 million from the fund. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's new Data Center Advisory Board, which met for the first time on Friday. At 6 o'clock, it'll be Labor Radio. At 6:30, it'll be Prison Pipeline with more on the ICE use of tear gas. Then at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of about 47 degrees, and tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 56. Today in history, on this date in 1955, 15-year-old Claudette Colvin was arrested because she refused to give up her seat on a bus in segregated Montgomery, Alabama. It took clear until 2021, 6 decades later, before all the charges were expunged from her record. The quote of the day is from Ms. Colvin, who said, quote, "I knew then, and I know now, that when it comes to justice, there is no easy way to get it. You can't sugarcoat it. You have to take a stand and say, this is not right," unquote.
Lawmakers respond to the Iran strikes as Americans express disapproval. Indiana rejects shortening early voting, and Texas voters kick off the 2026 midterms on Tuesday. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy and historic times. We're not going to occupy the country. We're going to give the people of Iran a chance to do something they've never had before, chart their own destiny. We're going to take away from any future regime, any future government, the ability to have a ballistic missile program, a nuclear program, or support terrorism.
Iran hawk and Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham says the U.S. won't put boots on the ground in Iran, but will hobble its capacity to attack others. President Donald Trump announced that the airstrikes launched with Israel killed Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the hardline Iranian cleric who ruled the country for four decades. But counterattacks on a base in Kuwait killed three American troops, and missiles and explosions hit Bahrain, home base of the U.S. Fifth Fleet. Iran says a large number of civilians have died, and there have been civilian casualties in Israel as well. The attacks in a region where much of the world's oil is produced or shipped could spark a sharp price spike. The United Arab Emirates has suspended trading on its stock exchange. A Reuters poll before the airstrikes found only a quarter of Americans support the attacks. More than half said Trump is too willing to use military force. Most Democrats and many America First Republicans in Congress say they favor a war powers resolution. That might limit Trump's authority to wage what some call an illegal war not declared by Congress. A vote on it could come as early as today, but even if it passes, the president will likely veto it. Democratic Virginia Senator Mark Warner says the White House's plans for Iran seem based entirely on wishful thinking.
There was no imminent threat to America. So what are his goals? He owes it to not only the families of those three deceased servicemen, members. There will unfortunately probably be more. He needs to make the case when you start a war of choice why it was so critical.
Trump has said he wants Iranian protesters to take over the government, but thousands of them died in a brutal crackdown last month. How they could take power is far from clear. Dealing with democracy questions at home, Indiana lawmakers have rejected a curb on in-person early voting. The bill would have cut the early voting period almost in half. Supporters argue the current 28 days is high compared to other states, and cutting it would reduce costs. Democratic State Senator Fadih Kadora says reducing early voting was not a partisan issue, but would also not be wise.
Republicans and Democrats will be able to continue to vote, but it just makes it more convenient to vote, and I will always be on the side of making it more convenient.
Texas kicks off the primary season tomorrow, including closely watched Senate elections. In the Republican race, incumbent Senator John Cornyn faces a formidable challenge from controversial right-wing Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. On the Democratic side, State Representative James Tallarico faces off with Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett. A seminary student, Tallarico emphasizes his progressive Christianity. Crockett has made a name on social media as a black woman willing to confront Trump and his movement. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A task force in Alaska releases recommendations to allow psychedelic therapy if it becomes legal on the federal level. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A state task force in Alaska has released recommendations for making psychedelic therapy available if treatments are approved at the federal level. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
The Alaska State Legislature established the task force in 2024 to examine psychedelic therapies, which hold a lot of promise but are still considered experimental. Jenny Armstrong is a former state representative who was on the task force. She says the group tackled questions like how to make therapy accessible and how to offer safe and culturally competent care.
And the whole point of the task force was to bring up these types of questions so we're not scratching our head when this becomes medicalized and scrambling and being reactive, but we're actually being proactive.
The task force did not take a stance on whether psychedelic therapies are good or bad, but recommends Alaska incorporate them as they are legalized nationally. None of the task force's recommendations are binding, but Armstrong says they're meant to guide legislators on the type of laws the state would need to offer access. Armstrong says the task force recommends incorporating a training program for therapists and healthcare providers who want to guide therapy.
Everyone needs to go through this type of training because just being a doctor doesn't make you qualified to facilitate this type of care.
And she says the aim is to make training accessible so a diversity of people can become certified. She says that would ensure people getting treated are a good fit with the person who guides them. Armstrong says Alaskans could benefit a lot from psychedelic therapies if they're legalized. That's because the state has such high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, substance use disorders, and other mental illnesses. Psychedelic therapies are being studied to treat those disorders, and Armstrong says some of the research is promising.
There are so many folks who, through these trials, went from being suicidal and having treatment-resistant depression, unable to work, unable to function, to being in remission within months.
She says that can change how people and communities can thrive. For National Native News, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
There's a new career pathway for tribal students looking at wildland firefighting jobs. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on the partnership between the Bureau of Indian Education and the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
High schoolers across six BIE-run schools are participating, including Northwest High School in Shiprock on the Navajo Nation.
This just happened to occur organically.
Carmelia Bacenti is Dene and Chief Academic Officer for the Bureau of Indian Education. She credits President Trump's executive order on expanding educational freedom. They're also pitching the curriculum to colleges.
We are trying to somewhat steer them towards being stewards of our lands. That doesn't always happen.
Gar Fisher's with the BIA Division of Wildland Fire Management. He says they're teaching coursework about leadership, fire suppression, and FEMA readiness. Once done, students put their training to the test during a field day.
They get to put the gear on, how it feels, they get to look like a firefighter.
That equipment is expensive, says Bacenti, which is why the BIE is buying it now.
And that way, year after year, as we recruit more students at these schools and across the Bureau, you know, we have this PPE that we can use over and over and over.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new survey of 200,000 American students find many don't feel adequately prepared for major crisis situations. As Suzanne Potter reports, it also shows many have persistent worries about their safety in school and on the way to school.
A new survey of students in California and across the country finds widespread anxiety around general safety and disaster preparedness. The San Francisco-based nonprofit Youth Truth surveyed almost 200,000 students and 20,000 educators last school year. It found that 1 in 5 middle and high school students and 1 in 4 elementary school students often worry about their safety at school. David McKinney, Vice President of Youth Truth, says schools need to be highly responsive when someone reports a safety concern.
The one question that we think all district leaders should be asking themselves is, do our students and staff believe that their safety concerns are taken seriously? What formal and informal channels exist for students to actually report their safety concerns? How effective are those channels?
The data show a big disconnect between the way staff and students feel about disaster response. Only 45% of high school students agree that their school has taught them how to stay safe in a natural disaster, compared to 80% of staff. Camilla Valerio, a lead researcher with Youth Truth, says schools need to give students some hands-on training so they know what to do in an emergency.
School leaders should look at their students more as active participants in these safety procedures versus passive participants. Schools are a learning ground, and hopefully the skills that they're learning within that environment can be translated into their communities.
The data shows students often reported feeling less safe in the bathroom or on the school bus. Socio Mendez is director of transportation at Keppel Union School District in the Antelope Valley outside of Los Angeles. She says kids feel safe when they feel seen.
Students may not see the behind-the-scenes work, like safety compliance, driver training, inspections, and route planning, but they do feel the impact. They know our transportation staff truly care. Every decision centers on their safety, because students feel safest when they feel recognized and valued.
The data also found that Black, Indigenous, and Latino students worry about their safety at higher rates than White or Asian American students. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 2nd, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Doug McVeigh, Dave Johnson, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings. Our engineer is Nick Capurso. Special thanks to Zamon Perez, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Isabel Charlet. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're getting a look at the first meeting of the governor's new data center advisory committee. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Dave.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon Data Center Advisory Committee was created by Governor Tina Kotek in January to come up with policy and regulatory recommendations for data centers in order to pursue economic development opportunities. The committee met for the first time on Friday, February 27th. Here's committee co-chair Michael Jung, described on the committee's website as an energy and climate policy professional.
I think we're here because we all care about what is going to happen with data centers and with the state of Oregon. I think I will say that it's a conversation that many people are having, but it's also a conversation in which we're not all using the same reference points. We're not all starting from the same common understanding. We're not even using the same words to mean this, the same.